Side 2. Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 28. He climbed a ladder, slid it along a row of shelves, and reached a hand out to touch a thick leather volume. Demon laughed. "Do you think the reading function has returned, Harmonor?" The man smiled, but seemed so confident that for a second Demon half expected to see the golden rush of symbols down his arm, as the reading function signaled the content. Demon had never seen the lost function in action, of course, but had heard it described by his grandmother and other old folks describing what their great-great-grandparents had enjoyed. No words flowed. Harmon pulled his hand back. "Don't you wish you had the reading function, Demon-er?" Demon heard himself laughing yet again on this odd evening and was acutely aware of both of the young women looking at him with expressions somewhere between bemusement and curiosity. "No, of course not," he said at last. "Why should I? What could these old things tell me that could have any pertinence to our lives today?" Harmon climbed higher on the ladder. "Aren't you curious why the post-humans are no longer seen on Earth and where they went?" "Not at all. They went home to their cities in the rings. Everyone knows that." "Why?" asked Harmon. "After many millennia of molding our affairs here, watching over us, why did they leave?" "Nonsense," said Demon, perhaps a bit more gruffly than he had intended. "The posts are still watching over us, from above." Harmon nodded as if enlightened, and shuffled his ladder a few yards along its brass track. The man's head was almost touching the underside of the library mezzanine now. "How about the Voynix?"
"What about the Voynix?"
"Did you ever wonder why they were motionless for so many centuries and are so active now?" Demon opened his mouth but had nothing to say to that. After a moment he managed, "That business about the Voynix not moving before the final facts is total nonsense. Myths, folklore." Ada stepped closer. "Demon, did you ever wonder where they came from?"
"Who, my dear?"
"The Voynix." Demon laughed heartily and honestly at this. "Of course not, my lady. The Voynix have always been here. They are permanent, fixed, eternal, moving sometimes out of sight, but always present, like the sun or the stars."
"Or the rings?" asked Hannah in her soft voice.
"Precisely." Demon was pleased that she understood. Harmon pulled a heavy book from the shelves. Ada informs me that you are quite the lepidopterist."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Butterfly expert." Demon could feel himself blush. It was always pleasing to have one's skills recognized even by strangers, even by less than sane strangers.
"Hardly an expert, Harmon-er. Merely a collector who has learned a bit from his uncle."
Harmon came down the ladder and carried the heavy book to a reading table.
"This should interest you, then."
He opened the artifact. Page after glossy page showed colorful representations of butterflies. Demon stepped closer, speechless. His uncle had taught him the names of about 20 types of butterflies, and he had learned from other collectors the names of a few of the others he'd captured. He reached out to touch the image of a western tiger swallowtail.
"Western tiger swallowtail," said Harmon, and added, "Pterourus rotulus."
Demon did not understand the last two words, but he stared at the older man in amazement.
"You collect?"
"Not at all."
Harmon touched a familiar golden-black image.
"Monarch?"
"Yes," said Demon, confused.
"Red Admiral, Aphrodite Fritillary,
Field Crescent Spot, Common Blue, Painted Lady, Phoebus Parnassian," Harmon said, touching each image in turn. Demon knew three of those named.
"You know butterflies," he said.
Harmon shook his head. "I've never even really considered that the different types have names until this minute." Demon looked at the man's blunt hand.
"You have the reading function."
Harmon shook his head again. "No one has that palm function any longer. No more than they have comm function or geo-positioning or data access or self-fax away from nodes."
"Then," began Demon, and stopped in true confusion. Were these people taunting him for some reason? He had come to spend the weekend at Artist Hall with good intentions, well, with the intention of seducing Ada, but all in good humor, and now this malicious game? As if sensing his growing anger, Ada put her slim fingers on his sleeve. Harmon doesn't have the reading function, Demon Ur, she said softly. He has recently learned how to read. Demon stared. This made no more sense than celebrating one's 99th year or babbling on about the Atlantic breach. It's a skill, Harmon said quietly, rather like your learning the names of the butterflies or your fabled techniques as a ladies' man. The last phrase made Demon blink. Is my other hobby so well known? Hannah spoke. Harmon has promised to teach us this trick, reading. It might come in handy. I need to learn about casting before I do more of it and burn myself. Casting? Demon knew fishermen who used that word. He could not imagine how it could have anything to do with burning oneself or acquiring the reading function. He licked his lips and said, I have no interest in these games. What do you want from me? We need to find a spaceship, said Ada, and there's reason to believe that you can help us. 6. Olympus. When my shift ends on the night of Achilles and Agamemnon's confrontation, I quantum teleport back to the Skolic complex on Olympus, record my observations and analysis, transfer the thoughts to a word stone, and carry it into the Muses' small white room overlooking the lake of the Caldera. To my surprise, the Muse is there, talking to one of the other Skoliks. The Skolik is named Nightenhelzer, a friendly bear of a man who, I had learned over the last 4 years of his residency here, lived and taught college and died in the American Midwest sometime in the early 20th century. Seeing me at the door, the Muse finishes her business with Nightenhelzer and sends him away, out her bronze door toward the escalator that spirals its way down off Olympus to our barracks and the red world below. The Muse gestures me closer. I set the word stone on the marble table in front of her and step back, expecting to be dismissed without a word, as is the usual dynamic between the two of us. Surprisingly, she lifts the word stone while I'm still there and closes her hand around it, even as she closes her eyes to concentrate. I stand and wait. I confess that I am nervous. My heart pounds and my hands clasp behind my back as I stand in a sort of professional parody of a soldier's at-ease position, are sweaty. I decided years ago that the gods cannot really read minds, that their uncanny perception of mortals' thoughts, heroes and Skoliks alike, comes from some advanced science in the study of facial muscles, eye movements, and the like. But I could be wrong. Perhaps they are telepathic. If so, and if they bothered to read my mind during my moment of epiphany and decision on the beach after Agamemnon's and Achilles' showdown, then I am a dead man. Again. I've seen Skoliks who displease the Muse, much less the more important gods. Some years ago, the 5th year of the siege, actually, there was a Skolik from the 26th century, a chubby, irreverent Asian with the unusual name of Brewster Lynn. And even though Brewster Lynn was the brightest and most insightful scholar amongst us, his irreverence was his undoing, literally. After one of his more ironic comments, it was about the mano-a-mano combat between Paris and Menelaus, winner-take-all, that would have settled the war on the outcome of that single combat. The one-on-one fight to the death between Helen's Trojan lover and her Achaean husband, although staged in front of 2 cheering armies, with Paris beautiful in his golden armor and Menelaus fearful with his eye full of business, was never consummated. Aphrodite saw that her beloved Paris was going to be hacked into worm meat, so she swooped down and spirited him off the battlefield back to Helen, where, like effete liberals in every age, Paris was more the happy warrior in bed than on the battlefield. So it was after one of Brewster Lynn's amusing comments on the Paris-Menelaus episode that the Muse, not amused, snapped her fingers and the billions upon trillions of obedient nanocytes in the hapless Skolik's body aggregated and exploded outward in one giant nano-lemming leap, shredding the still-smiling Brewster Lynn into 1,000 bloody shreds in front of the rest of us, and sending his still-smiling head rolling toward our feet as we stood at attention. It was a serious lesson and we took it to heart. No editorializing. No making merry with the serious business of the god's sport. The wages of irony is death. The muse opens her eyes and looks at me now. Harkenberry, she says, her tone that of a personnel bureaucrat from my century about to fire a mid-level white-collar worker. How long have you been with us? I know the question is rhetorical, but when queried by a goddess, even a minor goddess, one answers even rhetorical questions. 9 years, 2 months, 18 days, goddess. She nods. I am the oldest surviving Skolic, or rather, I am the Skolic who has survived the longest. She knows this. Perhaps this official recognition of my longevity is my elegy before explosive termination by nanosite. I had always taught my students that there were 9 muses, all daughters of Mnemosyne. Cleis, Euterpe, Deliria, Melpomene, Terpsichore, Erato, Plymnia, Urania, and Calliope. Each one granted, at least by later Greek tradition, control of some artistic expression, such as flute or dance or storytelling or heroic song. But in my 9 years, 2 months, and 18 days serving the gods as observer on the plains of Ilium, I've reported to, seen, and heard of only one muse, this tall goddess who sits in front of me now behind her marble table. Still, because of her strident voice, I've always thought of her as Calliope, even though the name originally meant She of the Beautiful Voice. I can't say this solo muse has a beautiful voice. It's more klaxon than Calliope to my ear, but it's certainly one I've learned to jump to when she says frog. Follow me, she says, rising fluidly and walking out the private side door of her white marble room. I jump and follow. The muse is god-sized, that is to say over 7 feet tall but in perfect human proportions, less voluptuous than some of the goddesses, but built like a 20th-century female triathlete. And even in the lessened gravity here on Olympus, I have to scramble to keep up as she strides across the close-cropped green lawns between white buildings. She pauses at a chariot nexus. I say chariot, and it is vaguely chariot-like, low, roughly horseshoe-shaped, with a niche in the side allowing the muse to step up into it. But this chariot lacks horses, reins, and driver. She grips the railing and beckons me up. Hesitantly, heart pounding wildly now, I step up and stand to one side as the muse taps her long fingers across a gold wedge that might be some sort of control panel. Lights blink. The chariot hums, crackles, becomes suddenly girdled by a latticework of energy, and rises off the grass, twirling as it climbs. Suddenly, a holographic pair of horses appears in front of the chariot and gallop as they seem to pull the chariot through the sky. I know that the holographic horses are there for the Greeks and Trojans' need for closure, but the sense that they are real animals pulling a real chariot through the sky is very strong. I grab the metal bar along the rim and brace myself, but there is no sense of acceleration even as the transport disc jigs and jags, swoops once 100 feet above the muse's modest temple, and then accelerates toward the deep depression of the lake of the caldera. Chariot of the gods, I think, and blame the unworthy thought on fatigue and adrenaline. I've seen these chariots 1,000 times, of course, flying near Olympus or above the plains of Ilium, as the gods shuttle to and fro on their godlike business, but I've always seen them from my vantage point on the ground. The horses look real from that angle, and the chariot itself seems far less substantial when you're in one. Flitting 1,000 feet above the summit of a mountain, volcano actually, that itself rises some 85,000 feet above the desert floor. The summit of Olympus should be airless and ice-covered, but the air here is as thick and breathable as it is some 17 miles lower, where the Skolic barracks huddle at the base of the volcanic cliffs. And rather than ice, the broad summit is covered with grass, trees, and white buildings, large enough and grand enough to make the Acropolis look like an outhouse. The figure eight of the Lake of the Caldera at the center of the summit of Olympus is almost 60 miles across, and we zip across it at near supersonic speed.
Some force field or bit of godly magic keeping the wind from tearing our heads off, at the same time it muffles the sound.
Hundreds of buildings, each with acres of manicured lawn and gardens around it. God's homes, I presume, surround the lake, while great three-tiered otter triremes move slowly across the blue waters. Skolik Brustolin once told me that he estimated that Olympus was the size of Arizona, its grassy summit equaling approximately the surface area of Rhode Island. It was strange to hear of things here being compared to states on that other world, in that other time, from that other existence. Clinging to the thin railing with both hands, I peek out beyond the mountaintop. The view is breathtaking. We are high enough that I can see the curve of the world. To the northwest, the great blue ocean extends to that inverted cusp of horizon. To the northeast runs the coastline, and I fancy that even from this distance I can see the great stone heads that mark the boundary between sea and land. Due north is the scythe of the unnamed archipelago, just visible from the shoreline a few miles from our Skolik barracks. Then, nothing but blue again all the way to the pole. To the southeast, I can see three other tall volcanic summits thrusting above the horizon, obviously lower than Olympus's summit, but unlike climate-controlled Olympus, white with snow. One of them, I guess, must be Mount Helicon, home to my muse and her sisters, if sisters she has. To the south and southwest, for hundreds of miles, I can make out a succession of cultivated fields, then wild forests, then red desert beyond, then perhaps forest again, until land blends with clouds and haze and no amount of blinking or rubbing of eyes can resolve the detail there. The muse sweeps our chariot around and descends toward the west shoreline of the Lake of the Caldera. I see now that the white specks I noticed during our crossing of the lake are huge white buildings, fronted with columns and steps, graced with gigantic pediments, and decorated with statuary. I am sure that no Skolik has seen this part of Olympus, or at least seen it and lived to tell the rest of us about it. We descend near the largest of the giant buildings, the chariot touches down, and the holographic horses wink out of existence. Several hundred other sky chariots are parked helter-skelter on the grass. The muse removes what looks to be a small medallion from her robe. Harkonberry, I have been ordered to take you somewhere where you cannot be. I have been directed by one of the gods to give you two items that might keep you from being crushed like a gnat if you are detected. Put these on. The muse hands me two objects, a medallion on a chain and what looks to be a tooled leather hood. The medallion is small but heavy, as if it is made of gold. The muse reaches forward and slides one part of the disc counterclockwise from the rest. This is a personal quantum teleporter such as the gods use, she says softly. It can teleport you any place you can visualize. This particular QT disc also allows you to follow the quantum trail of the gods as they phase shift through Planck space. But no one, except the god who gave me this, can trace your path. Do you understand? Yes, I say, my voice almost quavering. I shouldn't have this thing. It will be my death. The other gift is worse. This is the helmet of death, she says, tugging the ornate leather headpiece over my head, but leaving it folded around my neck like a cowl. The Hades helmet. It was made by Hades himself, and it is the only thing in the universe that can hide you from the vision of the gods. I blink stupidly at this. I vaguely remember scholarly footnotes about the helmet of death. And I remember that Hades' name itself, in Greek, Ares, was thought to mean the unseen one. But as far as I knew, Hades' helmet of death was mentioned only once by Homer, when Athena donned it to be invisible to the war god Ares. Why on Earth or Olympus would any goddess loan this thing to me? What are they setting me up to do for them? My knees go weak at the thought. Put the helmet on, orders the muse. Clumsily, I tug up the thick leather. There are devices embedded in the material, circuit chips, nanotech machines. The helmet has clear, flexible eyepieces and mesh material over the mouth, and when I've pulled on the full cowl, the air seems to ripple strangely around us, although my sight is otherwise unaffected. Incredible, says the muse. She is staring right past me. I realize that I've achieved the goal of every adolescent boy, true invisibility, although how the helmet shields my entire body from sight, I have no idea. My impulse is to run like hell and hide from the Muse and all the guards. I stifle the impulse. There has to be a catch here. No god or goddess, not even my minor Muse, would give a mere Skolic such power without safeguards. This device will shield you from the sight of all the gods except the goddess who authorized me to give it to you, the Muse says quietly, staring at the empty air to the right of my head. But that goddess can see and track you anywhere, Hockenberry. And although sound, sand, even heartbeat is muffled by the medallion, the god's senses are beyond your understanding. Stay close to me in the next few minutes. Tread lightly. Say nothing. Breathe as lightly and shallowly as possible. If you are detected, neither I nor your divine patroness can protect you from the wrath of Zeus. How do you breathe lightly and softly when you're terrified? But I nod, forgetting the Muse cannot see me now. When she waits, still staring slightly askance, as if seeking me with her divine vision, I croak, "Yes, goddess." "Put your hand on my arm," she orders brusquely. "Stay with me. Do not lose contact with me. If you do, you will be destroyed." I put my hand on her arm like a timid debutante being escorted at a coming-out party. The Muse's skin is cold. I was once in the vehicle assembly building at the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral. The guide said that clouds sometimes formed under the roof hundreds of feet above the concrete floor. You could take the VAB and set it in one corner of this immense room we find ourselves in now, and you'd never notice it sitting there like a cast-off child's toy block in a cathedral. One says gods, and you think of the meat and potato gods, the main gods, Zeus, Hera, Apollo, and a few others. But there are hundreds of gods in this room, and most of the room is empty. Seemingly miles above us, a gold dome. The Greeks had not discovered the principles of a dome, so this was in contrast to the classically conservative architecture of the other great buildings I have seen on Olympus. Acoustically, directs conversation to all corners of the breathtaking space. The floor looks to be made of hammered gold. Gods lean on marble railings and look down from circling mezzanines. The walls everywhere sport hundreds upon hundreds of arched niches, each holding a white marble sculpture. The statues are of the gods present here now. Holograms of Achaeans and Trojans flicker here and there, many of them showing life-sized, full-color, three-dimensional images of the men and women as they argue or eat or make love or sleep. Near the center of the room, the gold floor steps down to a recess larger than any combination of Olympic-sized swimming pools. And in this space flickers and floats more real-time images from Ilium. Broad aerial views, close-ups, panning shots, multiple images. One can hear the dialogue as if the Greeks and Trojans were in this very room. Around this vision pool, sitting in stone thrones and lounging on plush couches and standing in their cartoon-like togas are the gods. The important gods, the meat and potato, known by grade schoolers gods. Lesser gods move aside as the Muse approaches this center pool, and I hurry to stay with her, my invisible hand tremulous on her golden arm, trying not to squeak my sandals or trip or sneeze or breathe. None of the deities seem to notice me. I suspect that I will know very quickly if any of them do. A Muse stops a few yards from Pallas Athena, and I stay so close to her that I feel like a three-year-old child hugging his mother's skirt. There is a fierce argument underway, even as Hebe, one of the minor goddesses, moves among the others, pouring some sort of golden nectar into their gold goblets. Zeus sits on his throne, and it is obvious to me at a glance that Zeus is the king here, he who drives the storm clouds, god among gods. No cartoon image, this Zeus, but an impossibly tall reality whose bearded, oiled, and palpably regal presence makes my blood turn to frightened course of this war, he demands, of all the gods, even while he stares daggers at his wife, Hera. Or the fate of Helen? If goddesses such as Hera of Argos and Athena, guardian of her soldiers, keep intervening, such as this stopping Achilles' hand in the act of drawing the blood of the son of Atreus, He turns his storm cloud gaze on a goddess lounging on purple cushions. Or you, Aphrodite, with your constant laughter, always standing by that pretty boy Paris, driving away evil spirits and deflecting well-cast spears. How can the will of the gods, and more important of Zeus, be clear even here, if you meddling goddesses keep protecting your favorites at the expense of fate? Despite all your machinations, Hera, Menelaus may yet lead Helen home, or perhaps, who knows, Ilium may prevail. It is not for a few female gods to decide these things. Hera folds her slender arms. So frequently in the poem is Hera referred to as the white-armed goddess that I half expect her arms to be whiter than the other goddess's arms. But although Hera's skin is milky enough, it's no visibly milkier than that of Aphrodite's or Hera's daughter Hebe or any of the other female gods I can see from my vantage point here near the image pool. Except for Athena, that is, who looks strangely tanned. I know that these descriptive passages are a function of Homer's type of epic poetry. Achilles is referred to repeatedly as swift-footed, Apollo as one who shoots from afar, and Agamemnon's name is usually preceded by wide-ruling or lord of men. The Achaeans are strong-greaved, and their ships black or hollow, and so forth. These repeated epithets met the heavy demands of dactylic hexameter more than mere description, and were a way for the singing bard to meet metric requirements with formulaic phrases. I've always suspected that some of these ritual phrases, such as Dawn stretching forth her rosy fingertips, were also verbal placeholders, buying the bard a few seconds to remember, if not invent, the next few lines of action. Still, as Hera begins to retort to her husband, I am looking at her arms. "Son of Cronus, dreaded majesty," she says, white arms folded, "what in the hell are you talking about? How dare you consider making all of my labors pointless? I'm talking sweat here, immortal sweat, poured out launching Achaea's armies, stroking these male heroes' egos just to keep them from killing each other before they killed Trojans, and taking great pains, my pains, O Zeus, in heaping greater pains on King Priam and the sons of Priam and the city of Priam." Zeus frowns and leans forward on his uncomfortable-looking throne, his huge white hands clenching and unclenching. Hera unfolds her arms and throws up her hands in exasperation. "Do what you please, you always do, but don't expect any of us immortals to praise you." Zeus stands. If the other gods are 8 or 9 feet tall, Zeus must stand 12 feet high. His brow is more folded than furrowed now, and I am using no metaphor when I say that he thunders, "Hera, my dear, darling, insatiable Hera, what has Priam or the sons of Priam ever done to you that you have become so furious, so relentless to bring down Priam's city of Ilium?" Hera stands silent, hands at her side. This seems only to increase Zeus's royal fury. "This is more appetite than anger with you, goddess," he roars. "You won't be satisfied until you knock down the Trojans' gates, breach their walls, and eat them raw." Hera's expression does nothing to deny this charge. "Well, well," thunders Zeus, almost spluttering in a way all too familiar to husbands across the millennia. "Do as you please. But one more thing, and remember it well, Hera. When there comes a day that I am bent on destroying a city and consuming its inhabitants, a city you love as I love Ilium, then don't even think about attempting to oppose my fury." The goddess takes 3 quick steps forward, and I am reminded of a predator pouncing, or some chess master seeing his opening and taking it. Yes! The 3 cities I love best are Argos and Sparta and Mycenae of the wide ways, its streets as broad and regal as ill-fated Ilium's. All these you can sack to your Vandals' heart's content, my lord. I will not oppose you. I will not begrudge your will. Little good it would do me anyway, since you are the stronger of us two. But remember this, O Zeus. Although I am your consort, I am also born of Cronus and thus deserving of your respect." "I never suggested otherwise," mutters Zeus. taking his hard seat again. "Then let us yield one to the other on this point," says Hera, her voice audibly sweeter now. "I to you, and you to me. The lesser gods will comply. Quickly now, my husband. Achilles has left the field for now, but a mewling truce makes quiet the killing ground between Trojans and Achaeans. See that the Trojans break this truce and do first injury, not only to their oaths, but to the far-famed Achaeans." Zeus glowers, grumbles, shifts in his chair, but orders the attentive Athena. "Go quickly down to the quiet killing ground between Trojans and Achaeans. I order you to see that the Trojans are the first to break the truce and do injury to the far-famed Achaeans." "And trample on the Argives in their triumph," prompts Hera. "And trample on the Argives in their triumph," Zeus orders wearily. Athena disappears in a QT flash. Zeus and Hera leave the room and the gods begin to disperse, speaking softly amongst themselves. The muse beckons me to follow with a subtle flick of her finger and leads me out of the assembly hall. "Harkenberry," says the goddess of love, reclining on her cushioned couch, the gravity, light as it is, giving emphasis to all her silky, milky-weighted voluptuousness. The muse had led me to this other room in the great hall of the gods, this darkened room with only the double glow from a low-burning brazier and from something that looked suspiciously like a computer screen. She had whispered to me to remove the helmet of death, and I was relieved to take the leather hood off, but terrified to be visible again. Then Aphrodite had entered, assumed her position on the couch, and said, "That will be all until I summon you, Mariti." And the muse had stepped out through a secret door. Mariti, I thought. Not one of the nine muses, but a name from an earlier era, where the muses were thought to be three. Mariti of practicing, Nemi of remembering, and Edie of... "Harkenberry, I was able to see you in the Hall of the Gods," says Aphrodite, blinking me out of my scholic reverie. "And if I had pointed you out to Lord Zeus, you would be something less than ashes now. Even your QT medallion would not have allowed you to escape, for I could follow your phase shift path through time and space itself. Do you know why you are here?" "Aphrodite is my patroness. She's the one who ordered the muse to give me these devices. What do? Kneel, prostrate myself on the floor in the presence of divinity? How do I address her? In my 9 years, 2 months, and 18 days here, my existence has never been acknowledged by a god before, not counting my muse. I decide to bow slightly, averting my eyes from her beauty, from the sight of pink nipples showing through thin silk, of that soft cusp of stomach sending shadows into that triangle of dark fabric where her thighs meet. "No, goddess," I say at last, all but forgetting the question. "Do you know why you were chosen as Skolik, Harkenberry? Why your DNA was exempted from nanocyte disruption? Why, before you were chosen for reintegration, your writings on the war were factored into the simplex?" "No, goddess. My DNA is exempt from nanocyte disruption." "Do you know what a simplex is, mortal shade?" "Herpes virus, I think." "No, goddess," I say. "The simplex is a simple geometric mathematical object, an exercise in logistics, a triangle or trapezoid folded on itself," says Aphrodite. "Only combined with multiple dimensions and algorithms defining new notional areas, creating and discarding feasible regions of end space, planes of exclusion become inevitable contours. Do you understand now, Harkenberry? Do you understand how this applies to quantum space, to time, to the war below, or to your own fate?" "No, goddess." My voice does quaver this time. I can't help it. There is a rustling of silk, and I glance up long enough to see the most beautiful female in existence rearranging her fair limbs and smooth thighs on the couch. "No matter," she says. "You or the mortal who was your template wrote a book several thousand years ago. Do you remember its content?" "No, goddess." "If you say that one more time, Harkenberry, I am going to rip you open from crotch to crown and quite literally use your guts for my garters. Do you understand that?" It is hard to speak with no saliva in your mouth. Yes, goddess, I manage, hearing the dry lisp. Your book ran to 935 pages, and it was all about one word. Menin. Do you remember now? No, I'm afraid I don't recall that, goddess Aphrodite, but I am sure that you are correct. I look up long enough to see that she is smiling, her chin propped on her left hand, her finger rising along her cheek to one perfect dark eyebrow. Her eyes are the color of a fine cognac. Rage, she says softly. Menin eidetea. Do you know who will win this war, Hockenberry? I have to think fast here. I would be a pretty poor skolic if I don't know how the poem turns out. Although the Iliad ends with the funeral rites for Achilles' friend Patroclus, not with the destruction of Troy, and there is no mention of a giant horse except in Odysseus' comments and that from another epic. But if I pretend to know how this real war will turn out, and it is obvious from the argument I have just overheard that Zeus's edict that the gods must not be informed of the future, as predicted by the Iliad, is still in effect, I mean, if the gods themselves do not know what will happen next, wouldn't I be putting myself above the gods, including fate, by telling them? Hubris has never been an attribute gently rewarded by these gods. Besides, Zeus, who alone knows the full tale of the Iliad, has forbidden the other gods from asking, and all of us skolics from discussing anything except events that have already occurred. Pissing off Zeus is never a good plan for survival on Olympus. Still, it seems I'm exempt from nanocyte disruption. On the other hand, I believe the goddess of love completely when she says that she will wear my guts for garters. What was the question, goddess, is all I can manage. You know how the poem, the Iliad, ends, but I would be defying Zeus's command if I ask you what happens there, says Aphrodite, her small smile disappearing and being replaced by something like a pout. But I can ask you if that poem predicts this reality. Does it? In your opinion, Skolic Hockenberry, does Zeus rule the universe or does fate? Oh, shit, I think. Any answer here is going to end up with me being gutless and this beautiful woman goddess wearing slimy garters. I say, it is my understanding, goddess, that even though the universe bends to the will of Zeus and must obey the vagaries of the god force called fate, that chaos still has some say in the lives of both men and gods. Aphrodite makes a soft, amused sound. Everything about her is so soft, touchable, enticing. We will not wait for chaos to decide this contest, she says, her voice shedding all sound of amusement. You saw Achilles withdraw from the fray this day? Yes, goddess.
You know that the man-killer has already prayed to Thetis to punish his fellow Achaeans for the shame that Agamemnon has heaped on him?
I have not witnessed this prayer, goddess, but I know that it follows the path of the poem. This is safe to say. The event is in the past. Besides, the sea goddess Thetis is Achilles' mother, and everyone on Olympus knows that he has called for her intervention. Indeed, says Aphrodite, that round-heeled bitch with the wet breasts has already been here to the great hall, throwing herself at Zeus's knees as soon as the old fool returned from his debauching with the Ethiopians at the ocean river. She begged him for Achilles' sake to grant victory after victory to the Trojans, and the old sod agreed, thus putting him on a collision course with Hera, chief champion of the Argives. Thus the scene you just witnessed. I stand upright with my arms down, palms forward, head slightly bowed, all the while watching Aphrodite as if she were a cobra, but still knowing that if she chooses to strike me, the strike will come much faster and more lethally than any cobra's.
Do you know why you have survived longer than any other skolic? Snaps Aphrodite.
Unable to speak without condemning myself, I shake my head ever so slightly. You are still alive because I have foreseen that you can perform a service for me. Sweat trickles down my brow and stings my eyes. More sweat forms rivulets on my cheek and neck. As skolics, our sworn duty, my duty for the last 9 years, 2 months and 18 days, is to observe the war on the plains of Ilium without ever intervening, observing without ever committing any act whatsoever that might change the outcome of the war or the behavior of its heroes in any way. Did you hear me, Hockenberry?
Yes, Goddess.
Are you interested in hearing what this service will be, Skolik?
Yes, Goddess.
Aphrodite rises from her couch, and now I do bow my head.
But I can hear the rustle of her silken gown, hear even the gentle friction of her smooth white thighs rubbing softly as she walks closer. I can smell the perfume and clean female scent of her as she stands so close. I had forgotten for a moment how tall a goddess is, but I am reminded of our respective heights as she towers over me, her breasts inches from my downturned face. For an instant, I must fight the urge to bury my face in the perfumed valley between those breasts. And although I know well that this would be my last act before a violent death, I suspect at this moment that it might be worth it.
Aphrodite sets her hand on my tense shoulder, touches the rough leather embroidery of the helmet of death, and then moves her fingertips to my cheek.
Despite my fear, I feel a powerful erection stirring, rising, standing firm. The goddess's whisper, when it comes, is soft, sensual, slightly amused, and I am sure that she knows the state I am in, expects it as her due. She lowers her face and leans so close that I can feel the heat of her cheek radiating against mine as she whispers two simple commands in my ear.
"You are going to spy on the other gods for me," she says softly,
and then, barely audible above the pounding of my heart, "and when the time is right, you are going to kill Athena."
7. Connemara Chaos Central. Counting Monmouth, there were 5 Galilean Moraveks in the pressurized gathering chamber atop the slab zone. The European construct was familiar to him. Quill-based prime integrator Astig Che, but the other 3 were more alien than Krakens to the provincial Monmouth. The Ganymedean Moravec was tall, elegant as all Ganymedans, atavistically humanoid, sheathed in black bucky carbon and staring through his fly's eyes. The Callistan was more Monmouth's size and design, about 1 meter long, only vaguely humanoid, showing sin skin and even some real flesh under clear polyamide coating, massing only 30 or 40 kilograms. The Ionian construct was impressive. A heavy-use Moravec of ancient design, built to withstand plasma torus and sulfur geysers, the Io-based entity was at least 3 meters tall and 6 meters long, shaped rather like a terrestrial horseshoe crab, heavily armored, with an untidy myriad of morphable appendages, thrusters, lenses, flagella, whip antennae, broad-spectrum sensors and facilitators.
The thing was obviously used to hard vacuum. Its surface was pitted and sanded and repolished, then repitted again, so many times that it looked as pockmarked as Io itself.
Here, in the pressurized conference room, it used powerful source repellers to keep from gouging the floor. Monmouth slab from it. None of the others introduced themselves via either infrared or tight beam, so Monmouth followed suit. It connected to nutrient umbilicals at his slab niche, sipped and waited. As much as he enjoyed breathing when he had the luxury of doing so, Monmouth was surprised that the room was pressurized to 700 millibars, especially with the non-breathing Ganymedean and Ionian in attendance. Then Astig Chai began communicating through micromodulation of pressure waves in the atmosphere, speech, lost-age English, no less, and Monmouth realized that the room was pressurized for privacy, not for their comfort. Sound speech was the most secure form of communication in the Galilean system, and even the armored hard-vac IO worker had been retrofitted to accommodate it. "I want to thank each of you for interrupting your duties to come here today," began the Quill Prime Integrator, "especially those who traveled from off-world to be present. I am Astig Chai. Welcome, Koros III of Ganymede, Repo of Callisto, Monmouth of the South Polar Prospect Survey here on Europa,
and Orpu of Io. Monmouth cycled in surprise and immediately opened a private tight-beam contact. Orpu of Io? Are you then my long-time Shakespearean interlocutor, Orpu of Io?
Indeed, Monmouth. It is a pleasure to meet you in person, my friend. How strange!
What are the odds of us encountering each other in person this way, Orpu?
Not so strange, my friend. When I heard that you were going to be invited on this suicide expedition, I insisted on being included.
Suicide expedition? After more than 50 Jovian years without contact with the post-humans, Astig Chai was saying, some 600 Earth years, we've lost track of what the PHs are up to. It makes us nervous. It is time to send an expedition in system toward the campfire and to find out what the status of these creatures has become and to assess if they are a direct and immediate threat to Galileans. Astig Chai paused a moment. We have reason to suspect that they are. The wall behind the European integrator had been transparent, showing the bulk of Jupiter above the starlit ice fields. But now it opaqued and then displayed the various moons and worlds moving in their stately dance around the distant sun. The image zoomed on the Earth moon rings system. For the last 500 Earth years, there has been less and less activity on the modulated radio, gravitonic, and neutrino spectrums from the post-humans, polar and equatorial habitation rings, said Astig Chai. For the last century, none at all. On the Earth itself, only residual traces, possibly due to robotic activity. Does the small group of original humans still exist? Asked Repo, the small Callistan. We don't know, said Astig Chai. The integrator passed his hand across the old board, and an image of Earth filled the window. Monmouth felt his breathing stop. Two-thirds of the planet was in sunlight. Blue seas and a few traces of brown continents were visible under moving masses of white clouds. Monmouth had never seen Earth before, and the intensity of color was almost overwhelming. Is this a real-time image? Asked Koros III. Yes. The Five Moons Consortium has constructed a small optical deep-space telescope just outside the bow-shock front of the Jovian magnetodisk. Repo was involved in the project. I apologize for its lack of resolution, said the Callistan. It has been over a Jovian century since we've resorted to visible light astronomy, and this project was rushed. Are there signs of the originals? Asked Orpu of Io. The descendants of your Shakespeare, Orpu said on tight beam to Monmouth. Unknown, said Astig Chai. The greatest resolution is just under 2 kilometers, and we've seen no sign of original human life or artifacts other than previously mapped ruins. There is some neutrino fax activity, but it may be automated or residual. In truth, the humans are of no concern to us right now. The post-humans are. My Shakespeare? You mean our Shakespeare? Monmouth tight-beamed to the big Ionian. Sorry, Monmouth. As much as I love the sonnets and even your bard's plays, my own concentration has been on Proust.
Proust? That aesthete? You're joking. Not at all.
There came a rumble on the subsonic spectrum of the tight band, which Monmouth interpreted as the Ionian's laughter. The integrator brought up images of some of the millions of orbital habitations moving in their stately ring dance around Earth. Many were white, others silver. As brilliant as they looked in the heavy light so close to the sun, they also looked strangely cold and empty. No shuttles, no evidence of ring-to-Earth neutrino faxing, and the convoy bridge of heavy materials being accelerated between the rings and Mars, observed as recently as 20 Jovian years ago, 240-some Earth pH ring years ago, is gone.
You think the post-humans are gone? Asked Koros III. Died off somehow or migrated?
We know there was a sea change in their energy use, chronoclastic, quantum, and gravitational, said the integrator. The unit was taller and a bit more humanoid than Monmouth, sheathed in bright yellow surface shield materials. His voice was soft, calm, carefully modulated. Our interest now turns to Mars. The image of the fourth planet filled the window.
Von Mote's interest in Mars was marginal at best, and his images of it were from the lost age. This world looked nothing like the photos and holos from that era. Instead of a rust-red world, this recent image of Mars revealed a blue sea covering most of the northern hemisphere, the Valles Marineris River Valley showing a ribbon of blue many kilometers wide connecting to that ocean. Much of the southern hemisphere remained reddish-brown, but there were also large splotches of green. The Tharsis volcanoes still ran southwest to northeast in dark procession, one with a visible smoke plume, but Olympus Mons now rose within 20 kilometers or so of a huge bay arcing in from the northern ocean. White clouds clumped and grouped across the sunlit half of the image, and bright lights glowed somewhere near Hellas Basin, beyond the dark edge of the Terminator. Monmouth could see a hurricane spiraling north of the Chrysi Planitia coastline. "They terraformed it," Monmouth said aloud. "The posts terraformed Mars." "How long ago?" asked Orfu of Io. None of the Galileans had any special interest in Mars, in any of the inner worlds for that matter, except for their literature. So this could have happened any time in the 2,500 terrestrial years since the break between Moravex and humanity. "In the last 200 years," said Astig Chai. "Perhaps in the last century and a half." "Impossible." Koras III's statement was flat and final. "Mars could never be terraformed in so short a time." "Yes, impossible," agreed Astig Chai, "but it was." "So the post migrated there," said Orfu of Io. Little Repo answered, "We think not. Resolution on our observation of Mars has been a bit better than that of Earth. For instance, along the coastlines..." The windows showed an area along a twisting peninsula north of where the broad Valles Marineris rivers, more of a long inland sea, actually, emptied into a bay, flowed through an isthmus, and then opened into the northern ocean. The image zoomed. All along the coast, where the land came down to the sea, sometimes showing red desert hills, elsewhere green and heavily forested plains, tiny black specks followed the shoreline. The image zoomed a final time.
"Are those sculptures?" asked Monmouth.
"Stone heads, we think," said Repo. The image shifted, and the shadow of one of the blurry images suggested a brow, a nose, a bold chin. "This is ridiculous," said Koras III. "There would have to be millions of these Easter Island heads to border the entire Northern Ocean." "We count 4,203,509," said Astig Chai. "But the construction is incomplete. Note this photograph taken some months ago during Mars's closest approach." A myriad of tiny, blurry forms pulled what might be a great stone head on rollers. The stone face was looking skyward, its shadow eyes staring straight into the space telescope. The tiny figures appeared to be attached to the heads by multiple cables, pulling them along, Monmouth thought, like Egyptian slaves hauling a pyramid block.
"Human workers?" said Orfu, "or robots?"
"We think neither," said Repo. "The size is wrong, and you notice the coloring of the figures on the spectral analysis bands."
"Green?" said Monmouth. He liked literary puzzles, not real-life ones. "Green robots?"
"Or a species of small green humanoids not previously encountered," Astig Chai said seriously.
Orphis of Io rumbled subsonic laughter.
"LGM," he said aloud.
"Question mark?" sent Monmouth.
"Little green man," Orfu of Io sat on the common band and rumbled again.
"Why were we called here?" Monmouth asked Astig Chai. "What does this terraforming have to do with us?"
The integrator returned the window to transparency. The bands of Jupiter and plains of European ice in the evening light looked dull and muted after all the vibrant inner system blues and whites.
"We're sending a team to Mars to investigate this and report back," said Astig Chai. "You've been chosen. You can say no now." The four remained silent on all communications spectra.
"I said report back," continued the Prime Integrator, "but not necessarily come back. We have no sure way of returning you to the Jovian system. Please signal if you would like to be replaced on this mission."
All four remained silent.
All right, said the European integrator.
You'll download the specifics of the expedition in a few minutes, but let me cover the high points. We will use Monmouth's submersible for the actual surveillance on the planet. Repo and Orfu will map from orbit while Monmouth and Koros 3 go to the surface. We're especially interested in activity on and around Mons Olympus, the largest volcano. Quantum shift activity there has been massive and inexplicable. Monmouth will deliver Koros 3 to the coastline, and our Ganymedean friend will carry out reconnaissance. Monmouth knew from his records and readings that lost-age humans had signaled pending interruption by clearing their throats. They made a throat-clearing noise. You have to excuse my stupidity, but how do we get the Dark Lady, my submersible, to Mars? That's not a stupid question, said the integrator. Orfu of Io? The giant armored horseshoe crab shifted on its propellers so that various black lenses looked at Monmouth. It's been centuries since we've sent anything in-system, and anything delivered the old-fashioned way would take half a Jovian year. We've decided to use the scissors. Repo shifted in his slab niche. I thought the scissors were going to be used only for interstellar exploration. The Five Moons Consortium has decided that this takes precedence, said Orfu of Io. I presume there will be some sort of spacecraft, said Koros 3. Or are you going to fling us one after the other naked like so many chickens fired from a trebuchet? Orfu's subsonic rumble shook the slab. He obviously liked Koros' image. Monmouth had to access the common net. A trebuchet was a lost-age human siege engine from their level 2 civilizations. Free steam, mechanical, but much more powerful than a mere catapult, able to launch huge boulders more than a mile. A spacecraft exists, said Astig Chai. It has been designed to reach Mars in a few days and configured to hold Monmouth's submersible. The spacecraft has an atmospheric entry package for Monmouth's submersible, the Dark Lady. Reach Mars in a few days, repeated Repo. What are the Delta V factors leaving Io's flux tube? Just under 3,000 gravities, said the integrator. Earth G's. Monmouth, who had never experienced a gravity load greater than Europa's, much less than 1/7 Earth G, tried to imagine 21,000 such G's. He couldn't. During acceleration, the ship, including the Dark Lady, will be packed with gel, said Orfu of Io. We'll be as comfy as circuit chips in a gelatin mold. It was obvious that Orfu had been involved in planning the spacecraft and Repo in observing the two worlds. Koros 3 had probably had advance warning about his command role in such an expedition. It seemed to Monmouth that only he had been left out of the preparation for this mission, probably because his role, driving the Dark Lady through the Martian seas, was so unimportant. Perhaps he thought, I should opt out of this expedition after all. Proust, he tight-beamed the big Ionian. Too bad we aren't going to Earth, my friend. We could visit Stratford-on-Avon, buy a souvenir mug. It was an old joke between them, but in the present context it seemed funny again. Monmouth tight-beamed a decent simulacrum of Orfu's heavy laughter, and the big construct rumbled so heavily in return that all four of the others could hear it through the thick air. Repo was not laughing. He was obviously computing. Such a scissors fling would give us an initial velocity of almost 2/10 light speed, and even after a drastic magnetic scoop deceleration in system, we'll have an approach velocity of about 1/1000th light speed, more than 300 kilometers per second. We'll get to Mars quickly enough, even while it's on the far side of the sun as it is now. But has anyone given any thought as to how we might slow down once we get there?
Yes, said Orfu of Io, his rumbling abating. We've given that some thought.
Even after 30 Jovian years of existence, Monmouth had no one to say goodbye to on Europa. His exploration partner, Ertzweil, had been destroyed in a closing lead near Pwll Crater 18J years earlier, and Monmouth had grown close to no other conscious entity since then. 16 hours after the conference, Connemara Chaos Central ordered dedicated orbital tugs to lift the Dark Lady out of an open lead and boost it into orbit, where Hardvac Moravex supervised by Orfu of Io, tuck the submersible into the waiting Mars craft and let ancient interlunar induction haulers truck the stack downhill to Io. Monmouth and the other three Expedition Moravecs had briefly discussed naming the spacecraft, but imagination failed them, the impulse faded, and from that point on they referred to it only as the ship. Like most spacecraft constructed by Moravex in the thousands of years since spacefaring began, the ship was something less than elegant, at least by classical standards. It was 115 meters long and was comprised primarily of bucky carbon girders with wrinkled radiation shield fabric wrapped around module niches, semi-autonomous sniffer probes, scores of antennae, sensors, and cables. This ship was notably different from Jovian system machines, primarily because of its gleaming magnetic dipole core and its sporty outrider deflectors. Packed away in its lumpy snout were four fusion engine bells and the five horns of the Matlock-Fennelly scoop. A 10-meter-wide pimple on the stern held the folded boron sail. Neither scoop nor sail would be needed until the deceleration part of the journey, and the fusion engines had nothing to do with the acceleration phase of the mission. Monmouth stayed inside the Dark Lady, now packed with gel, while Koros III and Repo rode 60 meters away, in the forward control module they'd come to call the bridge. The plan was for Repo to handle all navigation chores during their brief Mad Mouse ride in, while Koros III served as titular commander of the expedition. The plan also called for the Ganymedean to transfer to Monmouth's submersible shortly before the Dark Lady, emptied of its gel, was to be dropped into the Martian atmosphere. Once in the oceans of Mars, Monmouth was to serve as a taxi driver, delivering Koros III to whatever landing point the commanding Ganymedean chose for his land-based spying. Koros had been downloaded various specifics of the mission that would not concern Monmouth. Orfu of Io had installed himself in his crash on the outer shell of the ship behind the 10 solenoid toruses and in front of the sail cable struts, and was connected to the bridge and the submersible by every sort of voice, data, and comm link imaginable. Most of his non-technical conversation was with Monmouth.
"I'm still most interested in your theory of the dramatic construct of the sonnets, my friend. I hope we live long enough for you to analyze more of the cycle."
"But Proust..."
"All of your existence studying Shakespeare."
"Proust was perhaps the ultimate explorer of time, memory, and perception," replied Orfu.
Monmouth made a static sound. The scarred Ionian sent his rumble through the audio line.
"I look forward to convincing you that both can be enjoyed and learned from, Monmouth, my friend."
Koros III's message came over the common line. "Everyone might want to raise bandwidth on the visual lines. We're approaching Io's plasma torus." Monmouth opened all visual feeds as requested. He preferred to watch external events through Orfu of Io's lenses, but at the moment the more interesting views were from the forward ship cameras and not necessarily in the visible light spectra. They were accelerating toward the great red and yellow blotched face of Io, coming at the moon from below the plane of the ecliptic and making ready to pass over its northern pole just before flying into the Io-Jupiter flux tube. During the short trip in from Europa, Orfu and Repo had downloaded pertinent information about this region of Jupiter space. A creature of Europa, Monmouth had always focused primarily on sonar and some visual light perception within the black oceans there. But now he perceived the Jovian magnetosphere as the loud, crowded place it was. Looking ahead on the decametric radio bandwidths, he could see Io's Jupiter-thick plasma torus and at right angles to the torus, Io's flux tube running like wide horns to Jupiter's north and south poles. Far beyond Jupiter and its moons, beyond the magnetopause, Monmouth could sense the bow shock turbulence crashing like great white waves on a hidden reef. Could hear the upstream Langmuir waves singing in the magnetic darkness past that reef, and could pick out the ion acoustic waves crackling after their long voyage uphill from the sun. The sun itself was little more than a very bright star from Jupiter space. Now, as the ship swept up and over Io and into the flux tube, Monmouth could hear the Whistler mode chorus and hiss that the little moon made as it plowed through its own plasma torus, eating its own tail, as it were. He could see the deep bands of equatorial emissions, and had to tone down the decametric and kilometric radio roar coming from the flux tube itself. All of Galilean space was a furnace of hard radiation and electromagnetic activity. Monmouth had spent his whole existence with its background roar in his virtual ears, but passing from Taurus to flux tube so close to Jupiter sent violent cascades of tortured electrons hissing around their ship like banshees, screaming to be let in a beleaguered house. It was a new experience, and Monmouth found it a bit unnerving. Then they were in the flux tube, and Chorus 3 shouted, "Hang on!" before sound channels were drowned out by the hurricane roar. The Io plasma torus was a giant donut of charged particles stirred up within the trail of sulfur dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, and other gases left behind, and then accumulated again by Orfu's violent home moon. As Io sped in its fast 1.77-day orbit around Jupiter, slicing through the gas giant's magnetic field and plowing into its own plasma torus, it created a huge electrical current between Jupiter and itself, a double-horned cylinder of incredibly concentrated magnetic surges called the Io flux tube. The tube connected to Jupiter's north and south magnetic poles and created wild auroras there, while the horns of the flux tube itself carried a constant current of some 5 mega amperes and constantly produced more than 2 trillion watts of energy. The Five Moons Consortium had decided some decades ago that 2 trillion watts of energy would be a terrible thing to waste. Monmouth watched as Io's north pole flicked beneath them. Ejecta from various sulfur volcanoes, especially from Prometheus far south near the moon's equator, was being spewed 140 kilometers high and higher above the pockmarked surface, as if the violent moon was shooting at them, trying to make them turn back before they reached the point of no return. Too late. They were already there. On the common forward video, Repo's superimposed navigation brackets showed their proper insertion into the flux tube and projected alignment with the scissors. Jupiter rushed at them, rapidly filling the view ahead like a multi-striped wall. The physical blades of the scissors, that dual-armed rotating magnetic wave accelerator set within the natural particle accelerator of Io's flux tube, were 8,000 kilometers long, only a fragment of the flux tube's length of more than 500,000 curving kilometers connecting the north pole of Io to the north pole of Jupiter. But the scissors could move. As Orfu of Io had explained to Monmouth, "Angular momentum can be a many splendid thing, my little friend." The ship nestling Monmouth's beloved submersible had approached Io in the flux tube, even after full acceleration from the ion tugs, at a velocity of only some 24 kilometers per second, less than 86,000 kilometers per hour. At that speed, it would take more than 4 hours just to traverse the flux tube distance between Io's north pole and Jupiter's E-years to reach Mars, but they had no intention of continuing on at that creeping pace. The ship entered the crackling, roaring, twitching field of the flux tube, found the vertex of the scissors, aligned itself with the upper blade, and then used the tube's own accelerator properties to hurl the spacecraft solenoid through the 5-kilometer-wide field coils of the superconducting dipole accelerator. As soon as the ship entered the first gate, like some clumsy croquet ball passing through the first of several thousand wickets, the blade of the accelerator scissors began snapping open with a differential angular velocity nearing, and theoretically even surpassing, light speed. They were riding a rippling bullwhip 1 second and then flicked from the tip of it the next, using as much of that 2 trillion watts of energy as the scissors accelerator could grab. The ship, and everything in it, went from 0G to almost 3,000 Gs within 2.6 seconds. Jupiter zipped toward, past, and under them in an eye blink. Monmouth slowed all his monitors down so that he could appreciate the departure. "We are," cried Orfu from the outer hull. The ship and submersible strained, creaked, groaned, and whinnied from the G-force, but it was all made of tough stuff. The Dark Lady itself had been built to withstand several million kilograms per square centimeter of pressure in Europa's deep seas, and so were these Moraveks. Holy shit, said Monmouth, meaning to send the comment just to Orfu of Io, but managing to broadcast to all three of his colleagues.
Indeed, responded Repo.
Jupiter's broiling polar lights, the brilliant auroral ovals surrounding the gas giant's north pole, accompanied by Io's blazing footprint where the flux tube met atmosphere, flashed beneath them and disappeared astern. Ganymede, which had been a million kilometers away across the system a few seconds before, zoomed toward them, flicked past, and was lost to sight behind them. Yorick Salkis, said Koros III on the common band, and for a moment Monmouth thought the command Moravec was choking or cursing before he noted the slightly sentimental tone to his usually cool voice, and realized that Koros must have been referring to some region on Ganymede itself. A half-glimpsed, grooved, and dirty snowball flashing past that must be home to the Ganymedan. The tiny moon Himalaya, which none of the crew had visited or cared to, whipped by like a firefly with its hair on fire. We've passed through the Balshock front, reported Repo in his flat Callistan accent. Out of the local pond for the first time, at least for this Moravec. Monmouth glanced at his screens. Repo's readout reported that they were 53 Jupiter diameters out now and still accelerating. Monmouth had to check unused memory banks and see that Jupiter had a diameter of almost 142,000 kilometers before he got a sense of their speed. The ship was arcing above the plane of the ecliptic, but Monmouth vaguely remembered that the plan was for the sun's gravity to hook them back down toward Mars, which was on the far side of the sun at the moment. At any rate, navigation wasn't his concern. His job would begin when they landed in the ocean of Mars, and sailing there seemed simple enough. Rich sunlight, warm temperatures, shallow depths with no pressure to speak of, stars to navigate by at night, geo-positioning satellites that they'd drop into orbit so they could navigate during the day, almost no radiation compared to the surface on Europa, no Kraken, no ice. No ice. It all seemed too simple. Of course, if the post-humans were hostile, there was a good chance that the Moraveks would not survive the trip to Mars or the atmospheric entry. And even they did, there was a high probability that they could never return to their homes in Jupiter space. But there was nothing Monmouth could do about any of that now. His thoughts began to turn back to Sonnet 127. Everyone all right? Asked Koros III. Everyone reported in that they were fine. It took more than a few thousand gravities sitting on their respective chests to get this crew down. Morale was high. Repo began reporting some other navigational and spacefaring facts, but Monmouth wasn't really paying attention. He was already caught up in the gravity field of Sonnet 127, the first of the Dark Lady sonnets. 8. Ardis. Demon slept well and dreamt of women. He found it slightly amusing, if not odd, that he dreamt of women only when he was not sleeping with one. It was as if he required warm female flesh next to him every night, and his subconscious supplied them when his daily efforts failed. As he awoke, late, in his comfortable room at Ardis Hall, the dream fled in fragments and tatters, but enough remained, along with usual morning erection, to bring back a vague memory of Ada's body, or someone very much like Ada. Warm, white-skinned, perfumed, with full buttocks and round breasts and solid thighs. Demon looked forward to the weekend's coming conquest, and had little doubt this lovely morning that he would succeed. Later, showered, shaved, dressed impeccably in what he considered rural casual, white and blue striped cotton trousers, wool serge vest, pastel jacket, white silk shirt, and ruby cravat stone, carrying his favorite wood walking cane, and wearing black leather shoes a slight bit more sturdy than his usual formal slipper pumps. He breakfasted in the sunlit conservatory and learned to his satisfaction that Hannah and that Harmon person had left early that morning. Preparing for the evening's pour was Ada's cryptic explanation, and Demon did not have sufficient interest to ask for clarification. He was just glad the man was gone.
Ada did not bring up conversational absurdities such as books or spaceships, but spent the late morning with him serving his guide, reacquainting him with Ardis Hall's many wings and gabled corridors, its elaborate wine cellars and secret passages and ancient attics. He remembered a similar tour on his first visit there, and the feckless girl Ada leading him up a rickety ladder to the rooftop Jinker platform, and Demon, alert as ever to such revelations, had half-glimpsed a young man's heaven up her hoisted skirt as she climbed above him. He perfectly remembered the milky thighs and dark, stippled shadows there. This morning they climbed the same ladder to the same Jinker platform, but this time Ada gestured him ahead, only smiling at his gentlemanly protests that she go first. A smile, suggesting some vixen memory of the event he had thought had gone unnoticed by her at the time. Ardis Hall was a tall manor, and the Jinker platform, its mahogany planks still gleaming, thrust out between gables to an overhang 60 feet above the gravel drive, where Voynichs stood like rusted upright scarabs. Demon stayed back from the unrailed edge, but Ada ignored the exposure and walked right to the brink, gazing wistfully at the long lawn and distant line of forest. "Wouldn't you give anything to have a working Jinker?" she said. "Even if just for a few days?" "No, why would I?" Ada gestured with her long-fingered hands. "Even with just a child's Jinker, you could fly over the forest and river, over those hills to the west, fly on for days and days away from here, away from any fax port."
"Why would anyone want to do that?"
Ada looked at him for a moment. "You're not curious? About what's out there?" Demon tapped at his vest as if brushing away crumbs. "Don't be absurd, my dear. There's nothing of interest out there. Pure wilderness, no people. Why, everyone I know lives within a few miles of a fax port. Besides, there are Tyrannosaurus rexes out there." "A Tyrannosaurus in our forest?" said Ada. "Nonsense. We've never seen one here. Who told you that, cousin?" "You did, my dear, the last time I visited, half a 20 ago." Ada shook her head. "I must have been teasing you." Demon thought about this, about his years of anxiety over the thought of ever visiting Ardis again, about his Tyrannosaurus nightmares over the years, and could only scowl. Ada seemed to read his thoughts and smiled slightly. "Did you ever wonder, Cousin Demon, why the posts decided to keep our population at 1 million? Why not 1,000,001? Or 900,999? Why 1 million? Demon blinked at this, trying to see the connection in her thoughts between talk of a lost-age child's Jinker and dinosaurs and the human population that had been the same, well, forever. And he didn't like her reminding both of them that they were cousins, since old superstitions sometimes inhibited sexual relations between family members. "I find that such idle speculations lead to indigestion, even on such a beautiful day, my dear," he said. "Shall we return to a more felicitous topic?" "Of course," said Ada, blessing him with the sweetest of smiles. "Why don't we go down and find some of the other guests before lunch and our trip to the poor site?" This time she went first down the ladder. Luncheon was served outside on the northern patio by floating servitors, and Demon chatted amiably with some of the young people. It seemed that several more guests had faxed in for the evening's poor, whatever that was to be. And after the meal, many of the guests found couches in the house or comfortable lounge chairs on the shaded lawn in which to recline while draping their thin Terran cloths over their eyes. The usual time under Terran was an hour, so Demon strolled near the edge of the trees, keeping an eye out for butterflies as he walked. Ada joined him near the bottom of the hill. "You do not use the Terran, Cousin Demon?" "I do not," he said, hearing that he had sounded more prissy than he had intended. "I've accustomed myself to the things after almost a decade, but I don't indulge. You also abstain, Ada, my dear?" "Not always," said the young woman. She was twirling a peach-colored parasol as she strolled, and the soft light gave her pale complexion a beautiful glow. "I check in on the events now and again, but I seem to be too busy to become as addicted as so many are these days. Terrans do seem to be ubiquitous." Ada paused in the shade of a giant elm with broad low branches. She lowered and closed the parasol. "Have you tried it?" "Oh, yes. It was all the rage halfway between my 20s. I spent some weeks enjoying the excess of it all.
He could not completely strain out the tone of distaste at the memory. Since then, no. Do you object to the violence, cousin? Demon made a neutral gesture. I object to its vicariousness. Ada laughed softly. Precisely Harmon's reason for never indulging. You two have something in common. The thought of this was so unlikely that Demon's only response was to flick away dead leaves on the ground with the point of his walking stick. Ada looked up at the sun rather than calling up a time function on her palm. They will be rousing themselves soon. 1 hour under the cloth equals 8 hours of turgid experience. Ah, said Demon, wondering if her use of the cliché had been in the form of a double entendre. Her expression, always pleasant but bordering on the mischievous, gave no clue. This poor thing, will it last long? It's scheduled to go most of the night. Demon blinked in surprise. Surely we're not bivouacking down at the river or wherever this event is to be staged. He wondered if sleeping out under the stars and rings would improve his chances of spending the night with this young woman. There will be provisions for those who want to stay all night at the Foresight, said Ada. Hannah promises that this will be quite spectacular, but most of us will come back up to the manor sometime after midnight. Will there be wine and other drinks at the, poor? Asked Demon. Most assuredly. It was Demon's turn to smile. Let the others stay for this spectacle. He would keep pouring Ada drinks through the evening, follow up on her turgid line of suggestive conversation, accompany her home with luck and proper planning, just the two of them in a small carryall, pour the full force of his not inconsiderable powers of attention upon her, and with only an added bit of additional luck this night he would not have to dream of women. By late afternoon, experienced events, going on and on about Menelaus being shot by a poisoned arrow or some such nonsense, were gathered together by helpful servitors, and everyone departed for the poor site in a caravan of droshkies and carrioles. Voynich pulled the vehicles, while other Voynich trotted alongside as security, although, Demon thought, if there were no Tyrannosauruses in the woods, he failed to see a reason for security. He had maneuvered to be in the lead carriole with their hostess, and Ada pointed out interesting trees, glens, and streams as they rumbled and hummed 2 or more miles down the dirt path toward the river. Demon took up more room on their side of the red leather bench than he had to, even given his pleasant plumpness, and was rewarded with the feel of Ada's thigh alongside his for the duration of the voyage. Their destination, he saw as they came out on the limestone ridge above the river valley, was not the river exactly, but a tributary to the main channel, a literal backwater some 100 yards across, where erosion and flooding had created a wide shelf of sand, a sort of beach, on which a tall, rickety structure of logs, branches, ladders, troughs, ramps, and stairways had been constructed. It looked like a crude gallows to Demon, although he had never seen an actual gallows, of course. Torches rose from the shallow tributary, and the rickety contraption itself stood half on sand and half over water. End of side 2.